Chapter 29. The Golden Marlin looked like no other cruise liner ever built. There were no promenade decks, no stateroom balconies, no smoke or exhaust funnels. Her rounded superstructure was covered with rows of large, circular viewing ports. The only prominent features were a round, dome-like structure above her bow that housed the bridge and control room, while on the stern a high fin enclosed an opulent lounge and casino that revolved around stationary viewing ports. At 400 feet in length and 40 feet wide, she was in the same class as most of the smaller luxury cruise liners that sailed the seas. Until now, undersea tourist excursions were undertaken in small submarines that were limited in depth and distance. The Golden Marlin was about to change the history of cruising. With her self-sustaining engines designed by Dr. Egan, she could travel throughout the Caribbean Sea in depths up to 1,000 feet for 2 weeks before coming into port for food and supplies. Given the public's insatiable lust for leisure time activity, and with an economy that put increased amounts of spendable income in their pockets, ocean cruising had become a mushrooming segment of the $3 trillion international travel and tourism market. Now, with a submarine cruise liner, the horizon for undersea travel was about to spread immeasurably. "She's beautiful," exclaimed Kelly, as she stood on the dock in the early morning, staring up at the unique vessel. "The gold is a bit much," muttered Giordino, adjusting his sunglasses from the glare that glinted off the superstructure from the rising sun. Pitt was silent as he studied the seamless shape of the titanium hull. Unlike on older ships, no plates or rivets were visible. The big tourist submarine was a marvel of marine technology. He was admiring the workmanship when a ship's officer approached from the foot of the gangway. "I beg your pardon, but are you the people from Numa?"
"We are," answered Giordino.
"I'm Paul Conrad, the boat's first officer. Mr. Lash advised Captain Baldwin of your joining us for the maiden voyage.
Do you have any luggage?"
"Only what we carry," said Kelly, looking forward to seeing the interior of the boat.
"You'll have a stateroom, Miss Egan," said Conrad politely. "Mr. Pitt and Mr. Giordino will have to share a cabin in the crew's quarters."
"Next to the showgirls who perform in the theater?" asked Giordino with a straight face.
"No such luck," Conrad laughed. "Please follow me."
"I'll be with you in one moment," said Pitt. He turned and walked along the dock to a ladder leading to the water. A man and a woman wearing wetsuits were checking their dive gear before stepping down the ladder and entering the water.
"Are you the team who is going to inspect the bottom of the hull?"
A slim, handsome man looked at him and smiled.
"Yes, that's right."
"My name is Dirk Pitt. I was the one who requested your services."
"Frank Martin."
"And the lady?"
"And my wife, Caroline. Honey, this is Dirk Pitt from Numa. We can thank him for the job."
"Pleased to meet you," said a lovely blonde who nicely filled out her wetsuit. Pitt shook her hand, surprised at the strong grip.
"I'll bet you're an expert diver."
"Been doing it for 15 years.
"She can dive as well as any man," Martin said proudly.
"Can you tell us exactly what it is we're looking for?" asked Caroline.
"No sense in dodging the issue," replied Pitt. "You'll be looking for any sort of object that's attached to the hull, specifically an explosive device."
Martin looked unfazed.
"And if we find one?"
"If you find one, you find others. Don't touch them. We'll arrange for an underwater demolition team to remove them."
"Who do we notify?"
"The captain of the ship. It's his responsibility at that point."
"A pleasure meeting you, Mr. Pitt," said Martin.
"Likewise," Caroline spoke with a charming smile.
"Good luck," Pitt said warmly. "You'll make my day if you don't find anything."
By the time he reached the gangway, the Martins were in the water and diving under the Golden Marlin's hull. The boat's first officer led Kelly through a luxurious solarium and up a glass elevator etched with tropical fish to a comfortable stateroom on the manta deck. Then he showed Pitt and Giordino to a small cabin below the passenger decks in the crew's quarters.
I would like to meet with Captain Baldwin as soon as it's convenient, said Pitt. The captain is expecting you for breakfast in the officer's dining room in half an hour. The boat's officers and an inspection team from the boat builder that came aboard late last night will also be present. I'd like Miss Egan to attend, said Pitt in an official tone. Conrad looked uneasy but quickly recovered. I'll ask Captain Baldwin if he'll permit the lady to sit in on the meeting. Since this boat wouldn't exist if it hadn't been for the genius of her father, said Giordino curtly, I think it only proper that she be present. I'm sure he'll agree, Conrad said hastily as he exited the cabin and closed the door. Looking around the sparse and closet-like cabin, Giordino said, I get the impression we're not welcome here. Welcome or not, said Pitt, we've got to ensure the safety of the boat and its passengers. He reached into his duffel bag and handed Giordino a portable radio. You contact me if you find anything. I'll do likewise. Where do we start? If you wanted to send this vessel to the bottom and everyone with it, how would you go about it? Giordino looked thoughtful for a few moments. If I got away with a fire on the Emerald Dolphin, I might try the same game again. But if I wanted to send it to the bottom with no fuss or muss, I'd blow out either the hull or the ballast tanks. My thoughts exactly. You start with that scenario and search the ship for explosives. What are you going to look for? Pitt smiled, but there was no humor behind it. I'm going to look for the man who will light the fuse. If Pitt had hoped the captain of the Golden Marlin was going to be a model of harmonious cooperation, he was wrong. Captain Morris Baldwin was a man who walked a straight line and never deviated. He ran a tight ship and did not intend to have outsiders come on board and disrupt his set routine. His only home was the ship he served. If he had a wife, which he did not, or a home, which he found a waste of time, he would have been an oyster without a shell. His face was a stern mask, red, ruddy, and never cheerful. He gazed through beady, dark walnut eyes under heavy lids that were set and grim. Only the magnificent silver mane gave him an air of sophisticated authority. His shoulders were as broad as Giordino's, but he was a good 10 inches heavier in the waist. He drummed his fingers on the table in the officer's dining room and stared steadily at Pitt, who stared back without so much as a blink. You say the ship is in danger. I do, said Pitt, and so does Admiral Sandecker and a number of other high officials with the FBI and CIA. Nonsense, he said distinctly, his knuckles whitening on his chair's armrest. Just because one of our liners suffered a disaster doesn't mean there will be a repeat performance. This boat is as safe as they come. I've gone over every inch of her myself. Hell, I even supervised her construction. He looked around the table in irritation at Pitt, Giordino, and the four-man inspection team sent by the shipbuilders. Do what you think you have to do, but I warn all of you not to interfere with the operation of this boat during the voyage, or I swear I will put you ashore in the next port, regardless of whatever reprimand I receive from management. Rand O'Malley, a man every bit as gruff as Baldwin, smiled sardonically. As head of the inspection team, I can assure you, Captain, we will not get in your way, but I expect you to cooperate if we should find a problem with any of the safety systems. Search all you want, muttered Baldwin. I promise that you'll find nothing that will endanger this boat. I suggest you wait until you receive a report from the divers who are inspecting the lower hull, said Pitt. I see no reason to wait, Baldwin snapped. There is the possibility they may find foreign objects attached to the hull. This is real life, Mr. Pitt, Baldwin said indifferently, not some fantasy tale on television. For perhaps nearly half a minute, there was silence, total silence. Then Pitt was on his feet, arms outstretched, leaning on the table with both hands, his lips parted in a brisk, wintry smile, his eyes boring into Baldwin's. Giordino knew all the signs. Here it comes. Good old Dirk, Giordino thought blissfully. Give the arrogant jerk hell. It appears that you have no idea of the danger your boat is facing, Pitt said solemnly. I'm the only one at this table who witnessed the terrible havoc the fire created on the Emerald Dolphin. I saw men, women, and children die by the hundreds, some burning alive in agony, others drowning before we could get to them. The sea bottom is littered with ships whose captains thought they were invincible and immune to catastrophe. The Titanic, Lusitania, Morro Castle, their captains all ignored the omens and the danger signs and paid a heavy price. When it comes, Captain Baldwin, as it surely will, to this boat and everyone on board, it will come with lightning speed before you and your crew can react. The crisis will strike with overwhelming suddenness from a quarter you never suspected, and then it will be too late. The Golden Marlin and everybody on it will have died, and their deaths will be on your head. Pitt paused to stand up straight. The people who are determined to destroy your ship are doubtless already on board as we speak, posing as one of your officers, your crew, or perhaps passengers. Do you get the picture, Captain Baldwin? Do you? Strangely, Baldwin did not show anger. His expression was remote, without any show of emotion. Then he said tightly, Thank you for your opinion, Mr. Pitt. I shall take your words under consideration. Then he came to his feet and walked toward the door. Thank you, gentlemen. We sail in exactly 37 minutes. As soon as the room cleared, except for Pitt, Giordino, and O'Malley, Giordino leaned back in his chair and irreverently crossed his feet on the conference table. We sail in exactly 37 minutes, he mimicked Baldwin. Exacting old bird, isn't he? Made out of dung and concrete, that one, observed O'Malley. Pitt took an instant liking to the man, as did Giordino. I hope you take us more seriously than Captain Baldwin. O'Malley grinned with every tooth. If you're right, and I'm not saying you ain't, I'm not about to die on this extravagant folly to man's greed. Take it you're not fond of her, said Pitt, amused. She's overbuilt, snorted O'Malley. More expense and planning went into the palatial decor than into the true guts of the engineering systems. Successful sea trials or not, I wouldn't be surprised if she goes down and doesn't come up. Somehow, I hate to hear those words from an expert on ship construction, muttered Giordino. Pitt folded his arms across his chest. My primary concern is that the disaster will be caused by human hands. O'Malley looked at him. Do you know how many places a madman could set an explosive that would cause this tub to sink? If the boat is deep underwater, a rupture almost any place on the hull would do the trick. That, and a puncture in the ballast tanks. I haven't had time to study the plans and specifications of the boat, except very briefly last night, said Pitt. But there must be an underwater system for evacuation. There is, answered O'Malley, and a good one. Instead of lifeboats, the passengers enter their assigned pods. They can hold 50 people. Then the entry door is closed and sealed. At the same time, the outer doors open. A stream of air is sent into the ejection system, and the pods shoot free of the ship and float to the surface. Take my word for it, the system is efficient. I know. I consulted on the project. If you wanted to make the evacuation system inoperable, how would you go about it? Not a pretty thought. We've got to cover all the bases. O'Malley scratched his head. Causing a failure in the air ejection system would be the way I'd go. I'd be grateful if you and your team would check out any tampering with the system very carefully, said Pitt. O'Malley looked at him with his eyes half closed. I wouldn't do a sloppy job of inspection if my life depended on it. Giordino studied the fingernails on one hand objectively. Truer words, I hope, were never spoken. The mooring hosers were lifted off the bollards by the dock crew and reeled aboard the Golden Marlin seconds before the starboard thrusters were activated, and the boat began slipping sideways from the dock. Over 1,000 people had come to the dock to watch the maiden voyage of the first underwater cruise boat. On a reviewing stand, the governor of Florida and other officials and celebrities made mundane speeches. The University of Florida band played a medley of sea tunes and were followed by a Caribbean marimba and steel drum band. As the ship began to edge from the dock, both bands and the boat's orchestra combined to play the traditional sailing song, "Until We Meet Again." Streamers and confetti were thrown as the passengers and people on shore waved and shouted. The scene was very moving. Pitt was amazed at how many women wiped away tears. Even Kelly was swept up by the rousing bon voyage. Pitt saw no sign of the divers. His calls to Captain Baldwin on the bridge were not answered or returned. He felt extremely restive, but there was no way he could stop the ship from sailing. The boat was still in the channel, heading toward the open blue-green sea off Florida, when all passengers were asked to be seated in the theater, where First Officer Paul Conrad lectured on the operation of the submarine cruise boat and explained the evacuation system. Kelly sat on one side of the theater in the front while Pitt sat on the other side near the rear. There were 6 black families on board, but none of the men remotely resembled Omo Kanai. As soon as the lecture was over, a series of gongs rang and the passengers were directed to their evacuation pod stations. Giordino worked with the team of inspectors, searching for explosives or signs of damaged equipment, while Pitt and Kelly cooperated with the purser in matching up the passengers with their names and staterooms. The search went slowly. By lunchtime, they were less than halfway through the passenger list without getting to the crew members. I'm beginning to doubt he's on board, said Kelly wearily. Either that, or he's stowed away, Pitt said, as he studied the pictures of the passengers that had been taken by the ship's photographer when they'd come on board. He held up a photo to the light and studied the features of the image. Then he passed it to Kelly. Look familiar? She looked at the photo for several seconds, read the name, and then she smiled. There's a definite resemblance. The only problem is that this Mr. Jonathan Ford is white. Pitt shrugged. I know. Well, back to the drawing board. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, chimes sounded over the speakers throughout the boat, playing the song, "By the Sea, by the Beautiful Sea." It was the signal that the boat was about to submerge. The passengers all hurried to find chairs in front of the viewing ports. There was no noticeable vibration or decrease in speed as the boat slowly began to slip beneath the surface. The sea seemed to rise as the boat descended in a maelstrom of bubbles that quickly faded away as the bright sun and sky transformed into a deep blue liquid void. The magnetohydrodynamic engines ran silently, without tremor. Except for the water passing outside the viewports, the passengers had no sensation of movement. The air regenerators scrubbed out the carbon dioxide and refreshed the breathable air inside the boat. Though there was little to see at first, they remained absorbed in viewing a different world below the one to which they were accustomed. Soon, fish began to appear, taking little interest in the huge vessel as it trespassed into their kingdom. Brilliantly colored tropical fish in fluorescent purples, yellows, and reds swam past the viewports. The saltwater inhabitants were far more dazzling than their cousins in freshwater lakes and rivers. They soon faded above the sub as it sank into deeper water. A school of barracuda, their long, sleek bodies radiating as if coated with silver glitter, swam lazily alongside the boat, their dead black eyes peering for a meal, their lower lips protruding. They swam effortlessly, keeping pace with the boat. Then in the blink of an eye, they darted away and were gone. The passengers on the port side of the boat were treated to the sight of a huge sunfish, often called a mola mola. There was a white and orange metallic luster to its huge oval body, which was 10 feet long and nearly as high, and probably weighed in the neighborhood of 2 tons. A strange-looking fish with high dorsal and anal fins, its body looked as if it had forgotten to grow in length. The great tail was attached just behind the head. A friendly giant of the depths, the sunfish soon fell behind the boat. Marine biologists brought on board by the cruise line described the fish and explained their characteristics, behavior, and migration patterns in the sea. The sunfish was followed by a pair of small hammerhead sharks, no more than 5 feet in length. The passengers marveled that a fish could have developed with such a large foil across the front of the head, with its eyeballs perched on the ends. The sharks were curious and swam alongside the viewports, peering with one eye aimed at the strange creatures on the other side. Like the other fish, they soon tired of the giant intruder, swayed their tails gracefully, and propelled their sleek bodies into the gloom. Digital meters that read out the submarine's depth were mounted beside every viewport. First Officer Conrad announced over the speaker system that they were at 600 feet and approaching the bottom. As one, the passengers leaned closer to the viewports and peered downward as the seabed slowly materialized and spread below the boat, a landscape that once had held coral before the oceans had risen and was now covered with ancient shells, silt, and jumbled lava rock encrusted with sea life. Because vivid colors were lost at this depth, along with reds and yellows, the seafloor took on a greenish-brown tint. The barrenness was garnished by the myriad fish that inhabited the bottom. The passengers watched in wonder at seeing this alien world with a visibility of no more than 200 feet. In the forward dome that served as the bridge and control room, Captain Baldwin was carefully guiding the Golden Marlin 50 feet above the ocean floor, keeping a steady eye out for any unexpected change in the terrain. Radar and side-scan sonar read the bottom half a mile ahead and to the sides, giving the operators ample time to change course and ascend in the event of a sudden rise of rock. The course for the next 10 days had been laid out with extreme care. A privately hired oceanographic survey had studied the seafloor through the Channel Islands and marked the depths for the voyage. The boat now steered the set course with her onboard computers. The seabed suddenly fell away as the boat soared out over a deep trench that dropped 3,000 feet into the depths, 2,000 feet deeper than the limits set by the boat's architects for the hull. Baldwin gave the helm to his third officer and turned as the communications officer approached and handed him a message. He read it, his face taking on a questioning expression. "Find Mr. Pitt and send him to the bridge," he ordered a seaman, who stared, entranced by the sight outside. Pitt and Kelly had not taken the time to enjoy the underwater scenery. They were still holed up in the purser's office, studying the personnel records of the crew. When he was notified that the captain wished to see him, he left Kelly and walked to the bridge. He'd no sooner stepped through the door when Baldwin thrust the message at him. "What do you make of this?" he demanded. Pitt read the message aloud. "Please be advised that the bodies of the divers engaged to inspect the bottom of your ship have been found tied to the dock pilings beneath the surface of the channel. Initial investigation shows they were murdered by person or persons unknown who stabbed them both from the back, the knife blade penetrating their hearts. Await your reply." It was signed Detective Lieutenant Del Carter, Fort Lauderdale Police Department. Pitt was suddenly stricken with guilt, knowing it was he who had unwittingly sent Frank and Caroline Martin to their deaths. "What's our depth?" he demanded sharply. "Depth?" echoed a startled Baldwin. "We've passed the continental shelf and are in deep water." He pointed at a depth gauge mounted above the windows. See for yourself. The bottom is 2,400 feet below our keel. Turn around immediately, Pitt ordered curtly. Get into shallow water before it's too late. Baldwin's face hardened. What are you talking about? The divers were murdered because they found explosives attached to the hull of this boat. I'm not asking you, Captain. For the sake of the lives of everybody on board this boat, turn back and get into shallow water before it's too late. And if I don't, Baldwin challenged him. Pitt's green eyes turned cold as the Arctic Sea and pierced Baldwin as if they were ice picks. When he spoke, it was as if the devil himself were speaking. Then in the name of humanity, I swear I will kill you and take command of the ship. Baldwin jerked backward as if he was stabbed with a spear. Slowly, very slowly, he recovered and his white-mouthed lips spread in a taut smile. He turned and looked at the helmsman who was standing, stunned, his eyes as wide as automobile wheel covers. Reverse course and come to full speed. Then, does that satisfy you, Mr. Pitt? I suggest you sound the warning signal and send the passengers to the stations at the evacuation pods. Baldwin nodded. Consider it done. Then he turned to First Officer Conrad and ordered, blow the ballast tanks. We can double our speed once we hit the surface. Pray we make it in time, Pitt said, the tenseness lessening slightly, or we have a choice between drowning or suffocating while watching the fish swim by. Kelly was sitting inside the purser's office, sifting through the crew's personnel records when she became aware of a presence. She looked up and saw a man who had walked in the room without making a sound. He was dressed in a golf shirt and shorts. There was an ominous smile on his face. She immediately recognized him as the passenger she and Pitt had discussed briefly earlier. As he stood there without speaking, she studied his face, and a feeling of horror began creeping over her. Your name is Jonathan Ford. You know me? No, not really, she stammered. You should. We met briefly on the Emerald Dolphin. Kelly was confused. There was a close resemblance to the black ship's officer who had tried to kill her and her father, but the man standing in front of her was white. You can't be. But I am. The smile widened. I can see that you're mystified. He paused and took a handkerchief from the pocket of his pants. He dabbed a corner on his tongue and then rubbed it against the top of his left hand. The white makeup came off, revealing coffee brown skin underneath. Kelly stumbled from her chair and tried to run out the door, but the man grabbed her by the arms and pressed her against the wall. My name is Omo Kanai. My orders are to take you with me. Take me where? She rasped in terror, hoping against all hope that Pitt and Jordina would walk in the door. Why, home, of course. The answer made no sense to her. She was only aware of the evil in his eyes as he pressed a cloth damp with a strange-smelling liquid against her face. Then a black pit opened beneath her feet, and she fell into it.